And now we will have Mr. Fabrice Jonas. Unfortunately, we've been battling to get his camera to work, and we will only have his voice. Just an introduction of Mr. Jonas. He's played a key role as a political activist during apartheid in a variety of organizations. Of note, the United Democratic Front and the African National Congress, and has spent time in exile and returned to serve in organizations in South Africa before taking up political positions in the democratic government, having served as the finance MEC, or the provincial minister, in the Eastern Cape province, and also as the CEO of the Eastern Cape Development Corporation. He is also the former deputy minister, the national deputy minister of finance, and a member of parliament. More recently, he played a seminal role in civic activism against state capture. He, together with the former minister of finance, spoke out against corruption during the term of the former president Zuma. He is currently the board chair of South Africa's MTN Group and a non-executive director on a number of other company boards. He is also one of the four presidential investment envoys appointed by President Ramaphosa to attract $100 billion to South Africa. We are honored to have Mr. Jonas joining us today, and we are glad that the techies behind the scene were able to at least get his voice so that he can participate. So, Mr. Jonas, please, can you share your experiences? I know 10-15 minutes is not going to be sufficient, but let's make a start, and then we will take further inputs during the panel discussion.
Thank you very much for the introduction. The VC, esteemed leaders from government, business, civil society, academics, and colleagues. Let me begin by thanking you for inviting me to be part of this highly important webinar. Given that I have only 12-15 minutes to present, I will give a quick overview and I will touch on what I have observed across the continent, and then I will end up with 5 points which I believe will shape the new world. COVID-19 is a once-in-a-century type shock. History has taught us, the Great Depression being the most recent example, that crises of this scale and magnitude will profoundly reshape the next 50 to 100 years. Production and consumption patterns will fundamentally change. Technological transitions will be accelerated. Geopolitical dynamics will be accentuated. Technological transitions will be accelerated. And there will be fundamental rethink of the state and the market and the relationship between the two. What is certain is that the coronavirus pandemic poses the same challenges for the leaders of the African continent as it does for leaders elsewhere in the world. This is precisely for two reasons. Firstly, the large number of unknowns and uncertainties surrounding the virus continue to confound good policy making. We say listen to experts and scientists, but we are learning new things every day about the coronavirus and the medical science to combat it. Secondly, there is the life and death struggle to balance the economic effects of lockdowns with safe ways of dealing with the health crisis. In the midst of these unknowns, it is leadership and good governance which will be critical in dealing with the virus. So far, different responses have produced different outcomes. It is no accident, for example, that the US, Brazil, and the UK and Russia have suffered the most, or amongst the most pandemic deaths. Donald Trump, Bolsonaro, Boris Johnson, Putin are generally regarded as divisive and deeply flawed leaders. Compare this to the achievements in containing the virus of South Korea, New Zealand, Denmark, Germany, Taiwan, Singapore, and Vietnam. Apart from the fact that most of the successful nations are ruled by women, and I will refrain from drawing any conclusions from that, their leaders were thoughtful and methodical, willing to listen to experts and to proceed with the trust of their people. These countries have three things in common. The first is wise policy making based on consultation and advice of experts. Two, sound governance, which means the ability to implement those policies effectively to protect public health, save lives, and ensure that aid reaches where it is intended. And thirdly, a two-way street between the people and government, which flows from clear communication so that people understand what is being done and why. Social distancing cannot be enforced. It must be embraced by the populace at large. When it comes to leadership on the continent as vast as Africa, with 54 countries, there is not just one reality. But it would be fair to say that Africa on the whole has better fared than expected. In South Africa, President Cyril Ramaphosa's administration embraced policies based on listening to experts and was prepared to learn from what worked elsewhere in the world. The president acted early, and his message was well received across the nation, even as he was asking people to do unpopular and painful things. The country glimpsed a fleeting few weeks of unity. But the gap between intentions and implementation soon became apparent. The good start was somewhat squandered by mixed messages and exercise in old-style commandism and micromanaging that many found difficult to understand. Still, the sacrifice and hurting of the lockdown have not been for nothing. South Africa is one of the few countries in the world that had zero excess deaths during this period. But we should not flatter ourselves to believe that our president set an example to the rest of the continent. This kind of thoughtful governance was true of much of Africa. I would not want to call out everyone, but some of the leaders of governments that have stood out in the crisis include Uhuru Kenyatta of Kenya, Akufo-Addo of Ghana, Macky Sall of Senegal. Senegal, by the way, could soon be producing its own cheap coronavirus test that could produce results within an hour. There are others where the jury is still out. Egypt, which is one of the hardest hit countries in Africa, and Tanzania, which has been accused of covering up the true death toll. It might take years for us to reach full understanding of who got it right and who failed. From the beginning, assumptions were made that not only was Africa especially vulnerable to the disease, because of its dense urban slums, large numbers of people with chronic illnesses, inadequate public health systems, but that its governments were too weak to deal with such a crisis. Of course, it is impossible to know how much government action in Africa was effective in slowing the virus and how much was due to other factors. But the reality is that Africa as a continent is still the least affected by the pandemic, constituting less than 1% of the global cases and deaths. This may be partially the warm weather and partially the fact that Africa is a young continent. The median age in Africa is 19, while most of those who are dying are over 60. Less than 4% of Africans are over 60. Those who argue that this shows why Africans should not do lockdowns, of course, underestimates the extent to which Africans revere their elders and find these actuarial exercises distasteful. Perhaps the lower rate is due to many African countries understanding the hazards of infectious diseases and how to deal with them. Even as the pandemic was making way around the world, more Africans were dying of Zika virus in northern Nigeria and Ebola in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo than COVID-19. Nigeria, with a long experience of dealing with infectious disease and a heroic history of containing Ebola during the 2014 epidemic, was one of the several West African countries that launched mobile community door-to-door screening campaigns. Africa's familiarity with disease is similar to those Asian nations which were hit by outbreaks of severe acute respiratory syndrome, SARS, in 2002, swine flu in 2009, and the bird flu in 2013. However, even though Africa is the continent least impacted by the health crisis, it could end up the most damaged by economic calamity. South Africa, Nigeria, Ghana, Senegal, and Kenya have all implemented rescue packages of varying sizes to provide support to the poor and unemployed and to bolster their health system, just as tax revenues have literally collapsed. But costly as these are, they are tiny compared to the $1 trillion of stimulus that China, the US, or the European Union have been able to rustle up. African nations cannot simply spend their way back to recovery. The hard times have already tempted some countries towards authoritarianism, and the desperation and hunger of the many could precipitate social and political unrest. Without being alarmist, we are still at the beginning of this crisis. What is certain is that none of this is going to be easy. African economies have been flattened, and in order for these to come back to recovery, we cannot simply go back to old ways. I want to conclude by just raising 5 points which I think are crucial in defining the new world without getting into any discussion on those points. The first is the role of the state and market will be fundamentally rescripted. We need to rethink a new role for post-COVID state, one that is able to provide social protection for the poor and at the same time direct and influence the market towards higher and more equitable growth based on innovation and productivity. The so-called neoliberal model associated with small government, lower taxes, limited social wage spending, financial deregulation will almost certainly become a thing of the past. But as we look to reassert the role of the state, we must equally avoid typical failed state models of import substitution, nationalization, and price controls, and even strong capital controls that we remember so well on the continent. Chasing unsustainable grand plans that we have no capacity to implement or to afford will fail. The second point, general point, I think, is the weak leadership will cost lives. The pandemic has no doubt brought out the best and worst practice in political governance and leadership. Suffice to say, we must keep in mind that the very qualities required to defeat this virus, scientific know-how, capable and responsible governance and leadership, global solidarity, are what we will need for survival and prosperity in the years ahead. Thirdly, the COVID contagion will hit the African economy hardest. Underlying Africa's economic vulnerability in the face of COVID-19 contagion are a number of structural weaknesses. These over-dependence on boom and bust commodity export, weak intercontinental trade and logistics capability, and poor integration into higher production, a global value chain. However, all is not lost. COVID-19 has been an extraordinary setback, but the heartbeat of the African economy, the streets, the markets, the traders, the people, they remain very resilient and probably will be key to recovery. Africa was a net loser in financialized global growth model of the past few decades, but possibly it stands to benefit hugely from a new economy centered around green energy and lifestyles, digitization, and reconfigured global value chains. The fourth point is African countries do not have the balance sheets for a stimulus. Further compounding African countries' vulnerability is the current crisis that are high levels of foreign denominated debt and weak financial positions of many of the African countries. This implies that post-COVID recovery will reinforce inequality amongst and between nations, between those with balance sheet and those with weak balance sheets. We do not have the luxury of Japan, for example, which has the debt to GDP of more than 200%, but is able to implement a stimulus of $1 trillion. With a few exemptions, central banks in most African countries do not have the capacity to inject liquidity into financial systems. And if pursued in a non-deflationary context, could bring significant price stability. Simply printing money, as some experts are advocating, will risk the Venezuelan option, which will hurt Africa for decades to come. The last point is that we need a Marshall Plan for Africa. A major shakeup in multilateral governance is imminent and necessary. For Africa, the main lesson of this is, in the words of Ghana's finance minister, that is time to challenge the unbalanced nature of the global architecture. The coronavirus has taught us that the existential threats of the 21st century, from the pandemic itself to inequality, climate change, and many others, they threaten all humanity. And the reconstruction of global demand does not end at one country's borders. This moment demands greater community between nations in fighting common enemy, including a global stimulus, a massive investment in infrastructure, fair terms of trade, and an easing of the unsustainable debt burden. This would also mean taking on the oligarchs and multinationals who have stashed so much of the world's wealth in tax havens. While we could argue that Africa is a special case and that the developed world owes us a special debt, we are not looking for handouts. We cannot look for handouts. A world hungry for demand will increasingly look to young Africa as a massive dynamic emerging consumer market. Investors will look to Africa as more profitable destination than some of the low growth economies of the developed world. At the same time, from a pan-Africanist perspective, Africa recovery and future will be closely tied to free trade area and integration that must now be accelerated for the continent. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sibisi Jonas. I think your pan-African insights are very valuable, and I think your five-point plan, in a way, has the key elements towards a Marshall Plan. I think the many points you've raised are coming across from the different webinars we've had so far. And I think I'm glad that we have this session to be able to pull together some of the key points that we should take forward post-COVID. Any other inputs on the environmental issues?
I guess the big issue really, I mean, if I'm following that from the last speaker, is that the many of the priorities like environment and even gender issues and all these other issues, given the constraints that we're likely to confront because of the health, the demands of fortifying health systems and strengthening research on some of these issues and a whole range of the measures and interventions that we need to have, they just might undermine some of the programs on environmental management, even, I mean, some of the progress that we've made on gender issues. So I guess the big challenge for civil society and governments is actually being very vigilant that we don't slide back as we fortify our health system to fight COVID-19. We actually ignore all other priorities in the face of this. And I would argue that's probably the dilemma that all of us would have to deal with and manage. It's very clear that I think regional cooperation and a kind of a continental action is going to be crucial, because in my view, I think we do need to promote multilateralism in responding to the pandemic. And part of it, I think, is understanding, and I tried to articulate this in some way, is that understanding that many countries can even not afford to actually come up with the packages that are required to deal with the pandemic, as it were. So it's a given that I think engagement with multilateral organizations is going to be probably a fundamental element of engaging in a new deal for Africa, in a new deal for the world, broadly speaking. And that's, I think, where our leaders should actually kind of galvanize their support towards. The second point I wanted to raise is that you know, whether we kind of like it or not, good governance must also entail a more vigorous focus on reducing and confronting corruption in different countries. And I think the pandemic opens this up both for civil society and for governments to realize that credibility and integrity of the state is fundamentally important and has to be protected. And part of it is actually being able to raise some of the, because this is probably one of the few and rare moments in history where dependence on the state is so huge, and it's likely to be so for a couple of years. And for that to work effectively, the integrity of the state, its capacity, its cleanness and addressing of corruption, etc., becomes an important element of ensuring that the state is able to deal with what it's supposed to deal with. Thanks.